This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Let's check in with Ed Feigenbaum with the HANA News Service. He is in charge of the Indiana Gaming Insight and the Indiana Legislative Insight newsletters that are available through the news service. And he's always here to talk about some interesting issues involving Hoosier gaming and related topics that may come up in the General Assembly when they're in session. And as always, Ed, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Hey, always a pleasure, Chris, even if we are a little bit earlier than usual.
Well, that's right, because we're starting the program an hour earlier than we usually do. It's on at 11 o'clock Northwest Indiana time now, and that would give lots of opportunity for folks like you in Indianapolis to be with us and still get that quick lunch in before you have to go back to work, I suppose.
Well, we appreciate that. We call it a sports betting break.
That's right. Well, in this case, it definitely is, because one of the things we want to talk about is a topic that was last discussed, I guess, when the General Assembly and after the passage of the gaming omnibus bill, as I know it's been called in some quarters, the changes that will come about here. We know the changes that the Indiana Gaming Commission has approved, and one of them in particular is the start this week of mobile gaming. Tell us, for folks that may have forgotten, what that's all about it is.
Well, you're going to be able to gamble, wager on sporting events from the comfort of your luxury skybox at home. Mm-hmm. As of October 3rd. The French Lick Resort and Casino has partnered with a national operator, the Rush Street Interactive folks, essentially based out of Chicago. They're involved in the Rivers Casino in Des Plaines and oversee that. And Rush Street is going to be operating a mobile sports betting app for French Lick, and French Lick is going to be the first one to have it. And that means that anybody can register if you are over the age of 21 with this app and start wagering after they put some money on deposit with Rush Street Interactive and the French Lick Resort and Casino, and they will be able to go live later this week with their gaming. Now, the timing is kind of interesting because the French Lick Resort is going to be hosting an LPGA tournament this weekend, so it looks like they really pushed to get things going in time for that particular tournament, a nice little marketing tie-in there.
I went back into the files at the Associated Press to dig up some stories here to take a look at the sports betting issue. And this one story that I happen to have that came out in the end of April, this was while the General Assembly was still considering what to do about the gaming issue in particular, quotes Senator Mark Messmer, who is a Republican. He's from Jasper, which, not surprisingly, is not too terribly far from the French Lick Casino. He was talking about the importance of having sports betting that would have a mobile app platform on it. That's what they opted to go to eventually. So it's kind of he maybe was the predecessor of what actually did happen when the General Assembly approved the bill and the Indiana Gaming Commission started to work on the regulations.
Right. Well, Senator Messmer was the author of the bill in the Senate, and he was the principal proponent of it, and he had to overcome a lot of opposition, particularly in the House, from those who felt that this was way too big an expansion of gaming. You know, there were a lot of legislators, particularly on the Republican side, who favored a particular type of expansion, whether it was for live dealers at the table games in Anderson or Shelbyville, or favored a move of the Gary Casino off the footprint inland within Gary, or favored the opening of a new casino in Terre Haute. Or even favored sports wagering, but did not believe that we should be able to do this from the comfort of our own couches, and that if you wanted to do this, you should have to go into a brick-and-mortar facility. Mm-hmm. The chairman of the House Committee on Public Policy, Representative Ben Smaltz from Auburn in Northeast Indiana, said that he just could not countenance the idea that we were going to be able to expand gaming literally into everybody's living room, when, in fact, you know, in 1993, you know, we'd started this with the idea of just a few limited riverboats that were all on the boundaries of this state, and that we had not really expanded things that significantly since then. And so he was concerned about that and ended up voting against it, and there were several of his colleagues who agreed with him. But obviously the majority of the General Assembly disagreed. The governor signed the bill. the Gaming Commission has worked incredibly quickly to make sure that this is happening. And in fact, any delay in the opening of the mobile portion of sports wagering versus the retail, the brick and mortar facilities that offer sports wagering, is not on the Gaming Commission. It's on the operators themselves, because the Gaming Commission was ready to approve anything at the time that the applicants had been able to get in their applications. There are a whole bunch of different requirements for mobile gaming that were not required of the brick and mortar facilities, including what we call geofencing, which means that, you know, once you hit, you know, a certain point on the skyway, or you cross over the state line on, you know, from the Borman into the Bishop Ford, you're going to not be allowed to bet. I mean, these things are precise down to, you know, a foot or 2 feet or whatever. And those kinds of things have to be certified, and they've got to make sure that the applications are working. They've got to make sure that everybody's got their own internal requirements in place and that they can be followed. They've got to test these things. And the Rush Street Interactive folks, on behalf of French Lick, were the first ones to come to the commission and say, hey, you know, here's our system. We think we're okay. Can you approve it? And then the commission went ahead and checked everything out and certified it.
Now, I'm thinking, when you mentioned this, what Rush Street Gaming was doing and setting up the process for the mobile app, we know that we're still in the process of working out this second casino license in Terre Haute, and that's still another issue that the Vigo County authorities are working on. Do you think they're going to have to make some adjustments if they do get a license for the casino in Terre Haute to be able to kind of set up the same kind of a procedure so that you can't go across the state line there off US 40 and keep it all within the sphere of the mobile gaming in Indiana?
Oh, absolutely. And you're only going to see one or two different contractors that are offering this geofencing service, and it's going to be available to all of the operators have to use something like that. You know, it doesn't matter whether you were Hoosier Park in Anderson or whether you're, you know, the casino in Terre Haute, which is not going to be on the Wabash River. You know, they're not going to have to worry about floating across there and screwing things up for those who want to bet on sports from Indiana. But you've got this requirement that is going to be enforced, and it's going to be enforced electronically. And the only real question with respect to that now is something that's been raised by some of the state colleges and universities that would be subject to sports betting, which would be like IU and Purdue and Indiana State and the University of Notre Dame. And some of those higher education institutions have come to the commission and said, hey, can you work it out so that we can geofence either our athletic facilities, you know, a football stadium, a basketball arena, or our entire campus? Because we don't feel comfortable necessarily, and you know how the NCAA has been out front in the sports wagering opposition over the years and is being kind of drag kicking and screaming into this. They don't necessarily feel totally comfortable with this with respect to their student athletes, and they want to protect them, and they want to protect the integrity of their institutions. And the Gaming Commission has essentially said to the higher education institutions, folks, you know, we can only do through regulation what we're authorized to do by the General Assembly. And right. The General Assembly did not authorize us to do this or ban this or whatever. And there are also cost questions. You know, who would pay for that? Would it be the universities? Would it be the state? And they didn't want to get into that as well. And then there are other kinds of practical questions, like, you know, how can you do this so it includes the parking lots of the sports facilities? Can you do it, or how do you do it when you're playing a game, for example, the home football opener this year for Indiana University and Ball State University was a match against each other at Lucas Oil Stadium in Indianapolis. Well, can you fence or geofence legally a venue that's not owned by or operating on the premises of a college or university?
Yeah.
And then, you know, if if you've got, for example, the basketball classic with Notre Dame and Purdue and IU and Butler that they play in December at the Bankers Life Fieldhouse in Indianapolis, well, that's literally steps away from the OTB in Indianapolis. And, you know, can you geofence without including that OTB? And so there are all kinds of practical questions there. And the Gaming Commission basically said, you know, we're not going to get involved in it. And, you know, universities, you're going to have to think about this yourselves. What Purdue University is doing, at the instigation of the Faculty Senate and with the approval of President Mitch Daniels, is that they're meeting on October 10th. They're going to consider a ban on university staff, students, and faculty, and administrators, obviously, from wagering on Purdue athletics, because not necessarily the integrity of the sports, which, you know, President Daniels and some of the faculty members there feel, you know, they can trust their athletes, but because of the relationships that some of the student athletes have and need to have with staff and faculty, and the faculty are concerned that perhaps a student might be reluctant to say something to a faculty member because it could be misinterpreted for gaming purposes. Like, well, I'm not feeling well, so I'm not going to go to class today. Well, is that inside information? And they don't want to jeopardize the kind of relationships that, you know, a normal student would have with a faculty member or a staff member simply because they are a student athlete. So it's going to be interesting to watch that debate and see how that turns out.
Well, do you think that that's the case that everybody, and in this case we're talking about IU and Ball State and Notre Dame and all the other state universities, whether they're privately owned or publicly owned, they're going to keep a close eye on this to see what Purdue does?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And as an alumnus of Indiana University, you know, all I'm concerned about is the point spread on football. You know, I'm not looking to bet on my team to win a whole lot of games for the remainder of this year.
You just want to be sure that the old Oak and Bucket game stays pristine, I suppose.
Yeah, and that's actually going to be kind of interesting now that, you know, Purdue had the two big injuries in the Minnesota game.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And, you know, those kinds of things really affect the betting lines, obviously, and you saw when Andrew Luck announced his retirement that all of a sudden some of the lines for, you know, the Colts winning the Super Bowl or the Colts winning the division just immediately changed, and some of the sports betting institutions, you know, some of the casinos that offered this in Atlantic City and in Las Vegas were a little bit late to react to it because, first of all, you know, it wasn't confirmed. It was on Twitter, even though it was an ESPN story. And so people were still able to kind of get in under the wire and wager when they knew that Andrew Luck was going to be retiring and you know, get in and change their bets or make new bets. So it's really a complex kind of industry with a lot of integrity concerns. It's going to be very, very carefully monitored, and we're going to have a lot of fun. I think, you know, you saw that first weekend of wagering in Lake County when the Bears were playing the Packers, that people were just really excited about being able to bet on, in particular, hometown teams.
I suppose this is, here again, it shows how complex this whole issue of gaming can be, how it's become, certainly, with the General Assembly enacting the changes for here in Gary, to be sure, and the licenses going from not only staying, you know, going off the riverfront to inland, and you say also, of course, the consideration in Terre Haute as well, too. I suppose it's really just gotten very complicated, yeah.
Yeah, and one other interesting point here, Chris, is that the mobile element that's going to be introduced is going to be a real game changer for Indiana, even though we've only had essentially a month of retail sports wagering. You know, it's going to be, you know, more of a change perhaps than moving, you know, a casino off a river or off of the lake to an inland location. We found in other states, and there are seven other states, well, now that offer mobile sports wagering. We found that, you know, as much as 70% to 80% of the business in those other states is mobile wagering. So all of a sudden, you know, we've built up these retail locations, and we've expected people to, you know, present with foot traffic there and you know, the casinos are all excited about all this new in-person traffic that they've gotten there. And then it's a lot of that is going to disappear almost immediately with the mobile wagering. So we're going to have a culture change within just a 4 to 6 week period of sorts when mobile wagering does get fully introduced within the state.
Do you think that the Indiana Gaming Commission meetings are going to be more complex? Not that they aren't already, because there's a lot of little details that they have to take a look into, I guess, from the owners and other sources out there every single month when they do meet. Are they going to have to deal with some of these issues on top of that now?
Well, they may, but I think that the key issues, you know, the criteria that they're going to use in the decision-making over certification have already been made. And, you know, you're just going to look at the same kinds of things that we've been seeing with the current casinos. You know, there are going to be violations that will have to be, you know, looked at every month. And, you know, we tend not to spend a whole lot of time at those commission meetings going through those violations. Those things tend to be resolved at the staff level, and mm-hmm. they're simply presented for the commission to make an up or down vote on. And, I think maybe in one or two cases over the past, 20-something years, can I recall the commission ever saying, well, wait a minute, you know, we're not real happy with this particular settlement agreement for a given reason. And I think in one of those cases was because something had changed drastically just between the time that the settlement agreement had been reached and the commission meeting had convened. So I don't expect that it'll be a real big deal for the commission. You know, obviously, you know, in the initial months and perhaps in the initial year or two, you're going to see a lot of attention paid to this by the commission because they want to set a tone. They want to make sure that everybody understands what the ground rules are, what acceptable conduct will be, and what kinds of rules and regulations cannot be breached in the least. So we're going to see, you know, some specific attention to that early, but I think that as time goes on, you know, things are going to become much more routinized and things aren't going to be quite as controversial, and it's going to be just like the rest of the kinds of gaming that we have in the state right now with the lottery and bingo and charitable gaming, the type 2 gaming in the bars and taverns, and horse racing, the lottery. You know, that it's just going to be part of the fabric of society, and it's going to be, you know, kind of a family and parental thing as to, you know, whether a husband tells a wife or a wife tells a husband, you know, honey, you shouldn't be spending that much money or that much time on, you know, your phone gambling or looking up the odds or educating their children as they, you know, reach the age of 21 or even maturity at this point, because, you know, there are some different ways around things illegally, educate them on the dangers of gambling at a young age.
Yeah, it sounds like it's going to be another issue that the Indiana Council on Problem Gaming or Gambling is going to take up here, I suppose, and how to deal with all of these issues of all these options that are out there now. And thank you very much for spending a lot of time with us to talk about this today. And we know that this is something that's going to be coming up. And certainly when you even look at the local issues involving the move in the casino in Gary, it's all going to be discussed again. And we will have a chance to bring it up again later. Thank you for spending time with us today to bring up the latest issues here about mobile gambling.
Well, thank you for having me, Chris, and we'll look forward to joining you again soon.
Well, good. Ed Feigenbaum is with the Hanna News Service, and he is the editor and this component of putting together the Indiana Gaming Insight newsletter. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Well, you know, it used to be that it was just a matter of being sent down to the front office, but it seems to have gotten a lot more complicated over the years as far as public schools and disciplinary cases are concerned. State of Indiana has gotten involved in the matter, too, and there's some concern about how maybe we as parents can do better. And for that, let's turn to Tammy Silverman, who's the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute. Tammy, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
My pleasure. Thanks, Chris, for having me back.
First, explain, if you will, what this new online portal that the Indiana Department of Education has set up here and why parents in particular should be very concerned about it.
Well, it's a great new way to look at information on discipline within your school system, right? And in, even in your own home school. So you can look at the high school level, middle school, that kind of thing. And what it really does is it tracks how many school suspensions, in-school suspensions, out-of-school suspensions, and expulsions are happening at your school, and then it compares it to the state average. And then you can actually drill down and look a little deeper. Are there certain groups of students, particularly kids of color, that are being disciplined in one of those categories at a higher rate than perhaps their white peers? So now it's all available at your fingertips, and that really encourages the educators, the schools themselves, to understand what that data is telling them. But it also makes it accessible to families and community members.
In general, what are you all finding at the IYI based on the information that the state has set aside as far as this this disparity between children of color, children or Caucasian, and other races as well, too, as far as the disciplinary matters are concerned?
Right. So we know that among Indiana students, right, so we're just looking at Indiana students, black and or African-American children are more than twice as likely to receive in-school suspensions compared to their white peers. We know the highest rate of in-school suspensions were black students, followed by multiracial, followed by Native American, and then Hispanic students. And the lowest rates were among Asian and white students. And so, again, we really need to take a look at what is that telling us, and are we applying the disciplinary standards differently to different groups of kids? And we know that nationally that is an issue. There is research that says the groups of kids are being treated differently.
I know that it's concerned that the American Psychological Association has taking a look at some of the work that their researchers have done as to whether some of these disciplinary techniques are really very good.
Right. Well, and I think, you know, it's that balance. And we hear this a lot from the educators that, of course, you know, they want to make sure that their classrooms are safe and that they're an environment where all kids can learn. And at the same time, sometimes the kids that are acting out or displaying negative behavior, pulling them out and giving them less access to school doesn't really make a lot of sense, right? Mm-hmm. Because they need that education. And, in fact, we know that kids that are involved in with school discipline are more likely to drop out of school, and they're more likely to become involved with the criminal justice system. So, of course, those are not the outcomes that our educators want or that we want for our kids.
Yeah. I know that even the state legislature has gotten into the matter. They were proposing and actually enacted a measure, which is now up for school districts to help take care of. Tell us more about that and what kind of impact that's going to have on the school discipline issue.
Right. And so just as you said, Chris, you know, I think it was a great move forward for our state legislature to recognize the idea that there is disproportionality in school discipline. And so they passed a law that is requiring the Department of Ed to provide schools with training and information on what are the best models for improving school behavior and discipline. And so kind of that first step is how do we improve the school behavior? Because if we can do that, hopefully we can prevent some of the discipline. So it really does call on schools to take a look at what their current practices are and give some other models and options for updating those practices as needed.
Now, Tammy, I know the Indiana Youth Institute has suggested questions that parents ought to ask on the matter of school discipline. We'll run down the list and outline your thoughts about this.
Of course. And this is coming from Child Trends, so from research that they do. First and foremost is asking, what does your school do to prevent the misbehavior? How does it outline expectations? How does it uphold those codes of conduct that they need to be enforced? Second of all, it's what behavior places my child at risk of removal from the class or from the school. Third is how and when does my school involve police? Number four is does my school use corporal punishment or seclusion and restraint? And finally, it is the last question is what is restorative justice and is it used in my school? And again, it's really encouraging families to have these conversations up front before it becomes an issue with a particular student. And often they do have some great responses, and we just want to make sure all the parents are familiar with those.
Now, does the State Department of Education look into and put into their data, too, where we have school systems that take advantage of local law enforcement to help out as school resource officers?
I don't think it doesn't track that specifically. It does track how many referrals there have been to law enforcement. And then you can take a look at that and see see, you know, is that number high or low compared to other schools that are similar and or in their areas.
So it's really a matter of knowing what the numbers are for your particular school system, or school for that matter, I guess, if we're talking particularly about a high school, and knowing what the high school is doing to deal with these issues. And you want to be sure that every student has an opportunity to at least safely learn what they need to learn for school.
Absolutely, and to have the conversations on if we know the numbers are higher than perhaps the state average or of schools similar to those. So. And again, you can pull it up. I pulled up the Merivale High School,
yeah.
And in looking at that, the in-school suspension rate at Merivale High School is 29.9%, and that is compared to a state average of 4.4%. So that's a pretty big difference, right?
Yeah.
And to have a conversation, even of schools that are similar to that particular school, is 8.9%. So have that conversation of how often is this used? What are those behaviors that warrant in-school suspension? And is there some other approach that maybe we could implement or have a conversation about that could put that more in line with the state and peer averages?
Well, it's interesting things to know, especially if you have a young person in high school or that's about to go into high school, to know where these figures stay in that particular school district that you're in. Thank you for the information today, Tammy.
Always my pleasure. Thanks for your interest in helping Indiana's kids.
Tammy Silverman is the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. The CDC estimates that more than 5 million Americans are living with Alzheimer's. Greg O'Brien is one of them. He's a journalist and the co-host of a podcast about living with the disease. It's called The Forgetting, and it comes from an NPR member station in Massachusetts. Side Effects Public Media's Isaiah Seibert talked with O'Brien about the stigma of dementia.
Greg O'Brien, thanks for joining me.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
And so you've been very open to sharing your experience with Alzheimer's. You have a memoir, podcast, and a series on NPR. Why is it so important for you to share your story?
Well, Isaiah, it's personal for me. I lost my maternal grandfather, my mother, my paternal uncle to Alzheimer's. And before my father died, he was diagnosed with dementia. Years ago, I started the symptoms and was diagnosed after a series of brain scans and SPECT scans and clinical tests and two serious head traumas that doctors said I shouldn't have survived, that they said exacerbated the diagnosis. And I also carry the Alzheimer's gene APOE4, and there's 50% chance that my children could have the disease and my grandchildren. My journey is not about me. No one really should care about me. I'm a journalist, okay? So just like you, you know, we're telling the story, reporting the story. It's trying to get people to focus on the disease, the inaccuracy of the stereotype of the disease, and building a critical mass to try to get people out and realize that we really have to stop this. And also at the same time, this disease can take 20 to 25 years to run its serpentine course. And experts will tell you that the pathology without symptoms can start when you're in your 40s. So this isn't your grandfather's disease. And my journey has been trying to get people to talk in faith, hope, and humor about Alzheimer's while the doctors and the researchers race for a cure. We wouldn't talk about cancer. We wouldn't talk about AIDS. We need to bring Alzheimer's out of the closet. And when you look at the people who haven't been diagnosed, who have the disease, who know they have disease and are afraid to talk about it.
And what do you hope people will take away when they listen to you?
I hope they look in the mirror. I don't want their pity. I don't want them to look at me. I hope they come to understand the disease. I hope they learn more about the disease. I hope they look to their families. I hope they look to relatives of the past. And I hope they learn more about it and be more open to it. Alzheimer's, as I said before, is not the end stage. It's not you're 80 years old and you're in a nursing home. It starts when you're in your 50s or your 60s. And most of the people in this stage are afraid to talk about it. They're afraid of losing their jobs. I know a lot of people who weren't able to do their jobs. It attacks sometimes the left brain more than the right brain. And so as a writer with right brain, it's been easier for me because I have strategies of a reporter, but it's horrible, and we need to just build a critical mass.
What responses do you get from people when they hear you?
It's interesting. There was a time that, I'll give you an anecdote. I gave a speech to the Alzheimer's Association in Maine a while back, about 500 people there. And what happens in this disease, I've always told people, your brain is like an iPhone in the early stages, and I'm in the early to mid stage. It's still a sophisticated device, but it has a short-term battery, it pocket dials, and it gets lost very easily, and it drifts out. And before I gave my speech, I was with my son, because I don't travel alone anymore. I can't drive. I can't drive a boat, anything like that. And I had a blackout. And the woman who was in charge of the speech came up to me, and she said, "Are you okay?" And I said, "No, but I'm going to give the best speech of my life, because I don't speak off the cuff. I write out everything I'm going to say." And when I got out to the audience, I said, "Look, here's what happens. Here's what just happened a few minutes ago. This is Alzheimer's in real time. I'm going to miss some spots. I'm going to forget where I am. Work with me." I missed spot, and they stayed with me. When I was done, they gave a standing ovation. I said, "Well, that's nice. Thank you very much." I didn't want it to be out of pity. And I was exhausted because the battery was dead. And I went into the lobby of this hotel in Maine just to decompress. And I looked up, Isaiah, and there were 100 people standing in line. They didn't want to talk to me about me because I didn't want to talk about me. They wanted to talk about them and their families. And I said, "Okay, they're getting it." And that's the reason for this journey.
You were diagnosed 10 years ago, is that correct?
About nine years ago. And if it's a 20-year disease, I could have another 10 years. I was diagnosed probably 10 years earlier before someone would have had a diagnosis, because I was the family caregiver for my mother and father who stumbled on this disease. And I had two serious head traumas, and I felt the symptoms coming on. And as an investigative print reporter, I couldn't multitask. I couldn't do my job. I needed help. So I reached out to one of my best friends who's my personal physician, and he connected me with the experts in the Boston area who did the test and the diagnosis. And early diagnosis is so important. Don't be afraid. Maybe that's one of the important things to say here. Anyone who is having a problem, please don't be afraid to have a clinical test. There's a difference between not knowing where your car is parked and not knowing you have a car, forgetting where your car keys are and not knowing where you have a car. And if you get to that stage, there was a time a couple years ago I took my, when I could drive, I don't drive anymore, so no one should be nervous, my yellow Jeep to the dump in Brewster, and we're unsophisticated on Cape Cod, so we actually take our garbage to the, it's kind of cool because I think they should have sports pubs there, and they do a lot of politicking there, and it's kind of a good, but anyway, I'm off track. You got to keep me on track. So I dropped my trash, and then I said, "Okay, how do I get home? I could call my wife. I could call my kids. A friend will drive me." My mind in the moment would not tell me that my four-door yellow Jeep that was sitting right in front of me was my car. And that's Alzheimer's in real time. So anyone who's experienced something like that, don't be afraid. That's the most important thing we're talking about today. Reach out. Reach out to professional people who know how to do this. You need to go to the best possible professional people who do these clinical tests. And if it comes out that you need help, it's okay, because you're going to be better off that way than the other way. It's a long journey. There are medications, there are strategies and pills. As the great Bugs Bunny once said, don't take life too seriously, because nobody gets out alive. So just help yourself.
You mentioned that there's a lot of misunderstanding surrounding Alzheimer's. Do you think that prevents people from seeking care?
Yeah, it's a taboo. It's the brain. I mean, Isaiah, it's called dementia. That's the umbrella word for cognitive impairment, of which Alzheimer's is the chief disease. Listen to the word. It sounds like a demon howling in the desert. And so nobody wants to go there. I don't know if you know this, I have cancer too, and I'm not treating it. And it's my exit strategy, because I've been to the nursing home with my mom and dad, and I'm not going to take my family there. I deal with intense depression, and we face bankruptcy. And it's not a sob story. It's just, I'm just an envelope for other people. But it's just understanding that there's help out there. And the greatest thing in Alzheimer's is the isolation. My mother used to talk about that. And I was there at her deathbed. I held her hand before she died. And I said, you know, we're going to start to talk about this.
So many people have secondary familiarity with Alzheimer's. They may know of a family member or friend who's living with the disease. But how do you describe it to people who have never experienced it?
Here's one way of describing it. When I would give a speech, I will ask people, how many people have ever lived in a home with a basement? Please raise your hand. People who are listening can think about that. How many people have ever done their laundry down in the basement? Please raise your hand. How many people have ever done their laundry down the basement when someone up in the kitchen didn't realize they were down there and shut the light off? It's penetrating darkness. And that's what early onset Alzheimer's is like. The light is on, the light is off. The light is on, the light is off. But you know one day someone is not going to be up in the kitchen to turn the light back on. The stereotype of it is you're 85 years old and you're drooling and you're incontinent. And by the way, I'm incontinent today, and there are times that I do drool. But it's you're in the nursing home and you can't speak. That's the final stage. This is a 20 to 25 year journey generally. There are cases where it moves quicker, but I will tell you this, that so many people from time to time say to me, well, my mother was diagnosed and she died 7 years later. To which I say, well, I mean, that's really so sad. But then I will say, in all likelihood, and I said there are always exceptions to every rule, is that your mother carried this disease for 20 or 25 years and was afraid to talk about it. And if we could get society to start to talk about this and empower people so they feel that you're not dead with this disease, you're just living with a demon that you have to fight every day, and you could still do good things. And I think that's a legacy, and I want that for my children. As I said, my journey is not for me. The train has left. I ain't coming back. But it's for my children, your grandchildren, and the children and grandchildren of people who are listening.
So you just talked about empowerment. In the podcast, you repeat three words a lot of the time: faith, hope, and humor. What do those things mean to you? Is it a source of empowerment for you?
Yeah. Well, the humor is pretty simple. I'm Irish Catholic, the most imperfect sinner in the world, by the way, and I've committed every sin a man can commit, but murder and adultery, but I have a strong faith in God. But I'm not proselytizing. Everyone finds their own level of faith, but it's a matter of faith and a higher power, I believe. And the hope is the hope for a cure. And the humor is what gets you through it, to be able to laugh. And in Alzheimer's, you become, in some ways, you lose your filter. There's some part of your brain that doesn't connect. And I joke about it that we become more Larry David-like, which childish-like. And I'm kind of enjoying it, where you say things that everyone else wants to say, but they're afraid to say. And all of a sudden, you say something, they go, oh, my God, I can't believe you said that.
You're no stranger to the disease yourself. You mentioned that some of your family members have had it. You've had it for going on 9 years now. But has there been anything in your journey of living with it that surprised you, that you weren't expecting at all?
People think of Alzheimer's as loss of memory. It's generally loss of short-term memory. But that's not what the disease is. The disease is a total breakdown of the body. The mind is the control panel for the body. So right now, today, and I could sit here because I'm prepped to do this, but after this interview, like I said, my brain's like an iPhone. My battery will be dead. It runs for a short period. But what people don't understand is that in Alzheimer's, it attacks at all different levels. It attacks in rage. 60% of my short-term memory can be gone in 30 seconds. If I go into a room anywhere where I've see people that I don't expect to see. 70% of the time, I won't know who they are. Now, I live in a place like Cape Cod. I hate cliches like it takes a village, but people there know me and they go, hey, and they kind of reintroduce themselves to me. You deal with, you know, intense depression. You deal with scary hallucinations. There's a numbness. I have no feeling now from my feet to my knees. It's neuropathy, but it's also brain signals not going down because the body shuts down because the brain is a control panel for the body. And it's like a death of a thousand cuts, and the depression is horrible, and it drives you into bankruptcy. But before people slit their throats, I want to say there's faith, hope, and humor in this. And I've always said, and I said in my book on Pluto, Inside the Mind of Alzheimer's, that lying down in wrestling, as in football, is a position of defeat. Don't lie down. If you can't get up, have someone help you get up. Reach out. Don't be afraid to talk about it. That's the most important thing. You do feel alone. I feel intense loneliness. That's why I call it Pluto. I think Pluto is the perfect metaphor for Alzheimer's. Look at the NASA pictures. Intense isolation, if you could just, in people's mind. That's what Alzheimer's feels like. But realize that there is a light out there, and reach for it. And that light is faith, hope, and humor in the company of others. And you can't fight this disease alone.
We got to the end of my questions. Is there anything else you want to add that we didn't touch on?
No, I just hope people reach out and talk, and that's the most important thing. We need to talk about this, and God bless anyone who's listening.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Greg O'Brien, for chatting.
Thank you. Take care.
That's Isaiah Seibert with Side Effects Public Media talking with a journalist who is living with Alzheimer's, Greg O'Brien. Once again, Rose Holman Institute of Technology in Terre Haute is offering up an opportunity for homework help for math and science subjects to Northwest Indiana students. We have with us to talk about the famous program known as Ask Rose. We have the director of Ask Rose, Susan Smith Rhodes, with us. Susan, thank you for joining us today on the program.
Well, thank you for encouraging your students.
It's been around for a while. Give us a little history lesson.
Ask Rose actually started in 1991 by Rose Holman. We had students who were calling and asking for some homework help, and so we decided that we would start Ask Rose. And it's a free service to helping students with their math and science. We focus on grades 6 through 12, and students can call us, they can chat, or they can email and get the help that they need.
How many tutors are available out there each evening that you make the this opportunity available?
More than 30 tutors available each evening. We have 140 tutors who actually work with the program. All of our tutors are Rose Holman students, so they're math, science, and engineering majors, and so they're very technically qualified. They also complete a training process and with communication skills. So their goal is to help students with their math and science the way that those subjects are taught in schools today.
Now, if a student has some problems that they're working on for an assignment that they have to turn in the next day, they've done all right to a point, but they've gotten stuck, how can they contact the folks at Ask Rose, and what kind of help can you offer them?
They can contact us at 877-ASK-ROSE, just a phone call away, or they can go to our website at askrose.org, and they can chat or email. And we're open Sundays through Thursdays. We are in Eastern time, so it's 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern time or 6 to 9 Central time.
When you have so many students involved with such an effort to try to help students out on the phone or online to get their math or science questions answered, what kind of resources do you all have to work with to try to get those answers?
Well, we have a lot of computer resources. We also have math and science textbooks for the state of Indiana. But if a student is also just working on a worksheet, the student can send us the worksheet and submit that to us. So we want to make sure that the student is comfortable, and we'll help the student in the manner in which the student is most comfortable. We also have about 500 online resources that can be found on our website.
Wow. Now, with all that help that you can offer up to students, there has to be some good news that comes back to you after getting a student out of a particularly tough problem. Do you ever get any word back on thank you for helping me out?
Yes, we do. We do assessments every evening of the program, and we'll ask students, did the tutor spend enough time helping you? Could you answer a similar problem? And our assessment shows that 99% of the students say they would use the service again and that they're very satisfied.
That's wonderful news to hear, and it's always out there, available. Once again, this 877-ASK-ROSE, that's on the phone, or you can go to the Ask Rose website, which is askrose.org. And Susan Smith-Rhodes with the Rose Holman Institute of Technology, thank you for joining us and telling us about, once again, a very popular and very informative and helpful program that will help high school students out with their math and science work. With another edition of Eye on the Arts, here's John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Karen Marvia, who is the president of the Downtown Hammond Council.
Good morning.
Good morning, Karen. How are you?
I'm wonderful.
You do so many things in downtown Hammond with the council, kind of leading the charge. And you are, I know that this is your favorite time of year.
It is.
As the holidays approach.
I love Halloween.
And you love Halloween especially.
Mm-hmm. The fall and Halloween.
So this is the Downtown Hammond Council's Haunting in Hammond that you're preparing for right
yes,
now.
Yes, exactly.
Tell us about it, please.
Well, if you love Halloween, if you love the fall, mm-hmm. and if you love these TV personalities named Sven Gulli mm-hmm. and Butch Patrick, mm-hmm. otherwise known as Eddie Munster of mm-hmm. the television series The Munsters, you can meet them along with seeing the coach and the Dracula from The Munsters. So if you love those old cars, you'll be able to see them at the event. And anything related to Halloween, and this is for adults and kids.
Mm-hmm.
So whether you are a kid at heart or you're an adult like me who loves Halloween, there's something for every member of the family to enjoy.
So this is an all-day-long event.
11 a.m. to 7 p.m.
And it's at EAT.
It's at EAT and outside of EAT. Homan and Sibley will be closed off.
Okay.
And there'll be lots of outdoor activities as well as indoor activities. So we'll have a Frank Enstein's Monster Market. So if you like to shop, uh-huh. we are going to have the best vendors out there. Everything from Halloween and oddities to upcycled, repurposed, handcrafted goods by local artists,
mm-hmm.
vintage, toys and collectibles, records. Really cool shopping.
Yeah.
And it's a great way to kick off the Christmas holiday shopping, which is, you know, will be right around the corner, too.
What is a hearse car?
They're called the Hardcore Hearse Club.
I see.
And I know, it's like, what is that?
These are vintage hearses?
These are vintage hearses. They go to all different shows, and they set up, and then they also sell all kinds of Halloween and oddities.
I see.
And they also bring, like, a coffin, and you can take pictures. It's very popular.
I can imagine.
People are dying to go.
Oh, I bet they are.
Ba-boom, boom.
That's fun. Hearse cars. It's sort of like a car show, but with a niche.
Yes, for Halloween. It's perfect.
That's fantastic. And EAT is a cool event space.
Yes.
Was it Woolworth's?
It was the former F.W. Woolworth's, right.
Days.
Yes, back in the day. So it's been lovingly restored.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a banquet facility, an entertainment center for the arts, and a bistro.
There will be food and...
Yeah, there'll be a bar so you can get delicious cocktails.
Uh-huh.
And you can shop inside, plus meet Sven Gulli. And then outside, there'll be Butch Patrick and his lovely wife, Layla, and the cars.
And Butch is the actual person who played Eddie Munster on
yes,
TV.
Yes, okay. Correct. And he is very friendly, amicable, gregarious. People are blowing up on Facebook and social media that they're both going to be at the same place at
he's
the same time.
He's not a little boy anymore, I take it.
No, he's a boy at heart, but he's now a grown man. But he'll have cool memorabilia to sell and things as well.
Oh, that's fun.
Sven
Gulli is always cool.
Oh, he is.
I enjoy him. We had him perform, well, not perform, but he made an appearance with the symphony a number of years ago.
When was that?
It was at a Halloween, one of the last times we did a Halloween concert.
Okay. Donna was trying to remember when it was.
Yeah. It was at least 10 years ago, I bet. So it's been quite some time. But I know that you have him come out, and that I think that's great. But he does that. He goes, he makes appearances all
he
over.
He does.
Yeah.
Exactly. And we book him a year. You have to book him a year in advance.
So this is one of the activities. You had a Beatles Fest recently. And what else do you have coming up, Karen?
We have You'll Love Hammond, Y-U-L-E.
Yes.
So we're working on the details of that.
Mm-hmm.
And then we do things like we do the spring and fall cleanups and Eat, Shop, and Rock, which is all about the 60s, 70s, and Beatles. So we do a lot of different things that are fun for the whole family to bring people to downtown Hammond. For Haunting in Hammond, I want to remind there's also going to be trunk or treat. So if business owners can come out and decorate their vehicles, and then the kids can go and safely get candy and have fun, dress up at the same, you know, at the same time. Mm-hmm. There's an adult and kids costume contest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you want to do something with a B horror movie genre because of the theme of who we have there, that's very fun.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to have some judges. Maybe we can get John Kane out there that day and do some judging.
We'll have to see.
He says, let me check at my schedule. She's putting me on the spot right now.
I'm sort of spotless at this point in my life. Spots just roll right off of me.
We also have Home Depot will be out there, and they'll be doing a fun children's activity, which is nice. So we're getting different events and activities added every day. It's nice to see that so many people want to be a part of this event. They're reaching out. A lot of times as a event organizer, you have to try and draw people in. And with this event, we have people contacting us from all over to be a part of it.
Well, it's special, and not everybody's doing something like this, so that's great.
And South Shore Arts Substation number 9 is going to be doing something that day, too.
Good. Well, I'm glad to hear it. Well, good. Thanks for being here, Karen, to tell us about the haunting in Hammond, Downtown Hammond Council. And thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
And you can hear this conversation and previous editions of Eye on the Arts on our website right now at lakeshorepublicradio.org. And tune in again next Monday for another Eye on the Arts conversation here on Regionally Speaking. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us. Tomorrow we have a conversation with Indiana political analyst Andy Downs. And we hope you can join us for that.